Hey folks, welcome back to Hash Rate Up. Today is all about DPO. I had the great pleasure of sitting down with Eric Neal, head of energy planning over at DPO, and we talked mostly about stranded wind assets and behind the meter Bitcoin mining and how they use Bitcoin mining as a weirdly shaped new tool in their toolkit in order to make stranded wind and solar assets more profitable. I hope you enjoy. Leave any questions below and stay tuned. All right. So like I said in the introduction, I am back this Sunday with Mr. Eric Neal. He is Director of Energy Planning at DPO. DPO stands for Digital Power Optimization. Today we're going to speak a bit about behind the meter energy and site development in the US. Today is an unknown date, but the block height at which we are recording is 836833. The 30-day hash rate is at 594.9 exahashes per second, and our hash price is at $108.95 per petahash per day, with a couple of weeks to go until the halving. With that being said, hello, Eric. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Great to be here.
You've done podcasts before, right?
I have.
What have you done in podcasting so far?
There's another one with a hash rate name in the title that is no longer running. The individual that was running that podcast has moved on to a career in a different business completely. But maybe we can throw a link in the comments or the notes for folks to view. There was a group session with a couple other people, one individual from Luxor that might be a guest of yours someday. And then one that was just me being interviewed, but there's a couple episodes out there.
Yeah.
I'm really excited for this one. You have a different audience.
Yeah, exactly. It being on Swan's Mining Channel also gives people a bit more exposure that previously hadn't dabbled in this, right? I just had Luxor on the previous episode, so they would probably have to start paying me before I have them on again. Can you give people a bit of background to yourself, Eric, how you stumbled over Bitcoin mining? Because I said in the pre-talk already, there's a lot of folks that would have not listened to Bitcoin mining content before, and they might not know who you are.
Yeah, well, your use of the word stumbled is probably accurate. So my background is in energy. I knew about Bitcoin prior to 2 years ago, but headline news, you know, hearsay, people talking about it. I never really dug in. And that's because I was working for a regulated utility and I was focused on developing energy projects, interfacing with regulators. And I spent almost my entire career in energy. Started in engineering as a thermal engineer, moved into some project development roles where it started with economic modeling to support regulatory applications, and then got a little bit more involved in leading some teams to coordinate some of the engineering, environmental, and stakeholder pieces to take really a business case concept for a project and make it actionable, where you have a complete story with enough due diligence done, where you can ask for money and ask for permission from your regulators to spend a bunch of capital to do a project. And I came across DPO at the same time I came across probably 50 other Bitcoin miners, because I was sitting in a team that was asked a bunch of questions from people who wanted to invest money in the territory that we had jurisdiction over. And we called that economic development, or at least the first step for economic development, where people would talk to us and say, this is how much energy I want. This is what I'd like to do. This is what I need. And we would do some feasibility assessment. And part of that was economics. And that was the role that I filled. And we had Bitcoin miners from all over the world calling every, I think, energy company in the United States saying, I need as much power. I need it right now. And I need it to be less than 4 cents, you know, per kilowatt hour. And we kind of got tired of having those conversations. Like, I'm sorry, I don't have 150 megawatts lying around at sub 4 cent power. You're going to have to go find that somewhere else. It takes a while for us to build that. And then DPO was on the other end of the line. They said, you're probably hearing this conversation all the time. We said, yeah. They said, sell power to those guys. That's fine. We don't have a problem with Bitcoin miners, but think about this a little differently. Think about this as energy infrastructure that helps you optimize existing assets that you have. And I kind of sat up in my chair and said, this is a different conversation. Okay, I'm paying attention. And they explained it to us as an energy resource. And that's when it finally clicked for me, was in that meeting. I said, oh, wait a minute, this Bitcoin stuff is actually really interesting. Tell me more. And after a couple of conversations, I actually called DPO and said, do you need an energy guy from the regulated side of the world? The answer obviously was yes. And I joined the team. This was probably March of 2022, or maybe it was April. So it's about 2 years I've been with DPO. And I call myself the energy guy. I think that's how I'm known on the team. I don't pretend to be a data center guy. I don't pretend to be the guy out raising capital for the projects, but I do understand all those pieces fit together and how they involve energy, and can have a dialogue with energy companies based on some experience in that industry and an understanding how regulators engage when utilities want to do something, or how the consumer advocacy groups engage when utilities want to do something, and, you know, go down the list of stakeholders that have something to say about whether a utility does or does not do something. And I've probably spent time in each of those areas interfacing with those counterparties. So
it probably having you on the team makes DPO a lot more quicker than the competition at execution, because you fully understand the more traditional angle of that partnership. Can you disclose, Eric, who made that click for you? Was that what person or what company?
It was DPO. That's when it
clicked. So they called and made it click at the same time. Okay, mm-hmm. Cool. All right, interesting. I am similar for me. Not quite as professional, but I studied energy economics, right? Not because of Bitcoin, but just because it interested me what happened behind the plug, right? And then you sort of enter this whole rabbit hole about energy trading and energy generation and transmission and all of that stuff, and the magic that really goes into keeping the lights on at all times. Well, here in South Africa, it's not all the time, but there's scheduled outages here at my house, as that we call demand response or load shedding. But anyway, it made me understand Bitcoin mining, I feel like, that much quicker, because you understand the energy angle. And it's there's a lot that goes into that. And it often takes folks a long time before they understand why Bitcoin mining is like the perfect consumer for any utility, right? So DPO is a typical Bitcoin miner. Is it comparable to other Bitcoin miners that are private out there, or is there anything that sets you guys apart that I'm missing?
I would say we don't consider ourselves a Bitcoin miner. We consider ourselves an energy management company, and we utilize data center technology to perform energy management services. Most of our energy partners are large renewable energy companies or utilities. Sometimes we get capital from large family offices. Sometimes the capital is vertically integrated in the company. So we're not interested in building Bitcoin mines for the sake of mining Bitcoin. We're interested in finding challenges on the energy grid and addressing them with data center technology. And Bitcoin happens to be really good at doing that. But DPO also develops other data center technologies that perform different functions and aren't as flexible as Bitcoin. So, you know, that's the long answer to, are we like other Bitcoin miners? I don't think so. You know, most of our clients liquidate their Bitcoin as soon as it's mined, just like they're settling energy transactions in the energy market. Right, it's just a mechanism for converting power into U.S. dollars.
Yeah, gives it a very different focal point that has probably different, as you said, treasury management strategies then attached to it as well. But it's just funny that, you know, you say, hey, we're improving your energy situation, and Bitcoin is the best at doing that. So that's the tool we're going to use, and it's just a wrench in our toolbox. And it's a funny looking wrench, so we have to probably explain it a lot. And what I want to get into today is how you do that and where you find sites and stuff like that, and what goes into, you know, having an behind the meter wind farm running, because there's a bunch of work and stakeholders employed in that process. Mm-hmm. And I feel like a lot of people don't understand that or appreciate that when they value these sites. And I'm also very happy to have, for the first time, I think, somebody who comes from the energy industry on the show, because this is supposed to be a show about Bitcoin mining and energy. And so far, I think it's been solely Bitcoin miners or people affiliated to the Bitcoin mining industry. To get started, Eric, can you give me a bit of color around what the current market or situation is for stranded energy or stranded power capacity in the US or selected states that you are familiar with?
Absolutely. So for the last 10 years or so, there's been a renewable energy boom in the United States, driven largely by investment tax credits and production tax credits from the federal government. And for wind specifically, there's a corridor down the middle of the country that's windy, which for obvious reasons is where people want to build wind, because you can get the highest volume of annual production out of a wind resource in a windy area and get the most production tax credits. And because of the production tax credits, you were able to, and still are able to, construct a wind resource in an area with very, very low market prices for power, because the federal government's giving you, you know, north of $30 a megawatt hour, you know, grossed up for tax, depends on your tax situation, but call it north of $30 a megawatt hour for every megawatt hour you put on the grid. And that's true if the grid prices are, you know, $50 a megawatt hour, $100 a megawatt hour, or negative $30 a megawatt hour, right? When the grid is saying, I have too much power and I want you to shut off, it does that by putting a negative price on the grid. And any dispatchable resource, you know, that isn't getting production tax credits is going to turn off or go down to minimum load. But these wind generators, they just keep pushing power onto the grid, because until it gets below, say, about negative 36 or 38 or 45, depending on the entity, it still justifies putting power on the grid, even though you're taking a loss in the market. So some might describe it, there's a considerable overbuild situation of wind in the middle of the country, and it caused all kinds of transmission congestion. And maybe the sophisticated developers saw this coming and knew just how much congestion there was going to be on the transmission system, and they built it into their financial models. But my suspicion is, because of how many entities we've talked to, not everybody saw the volume coming that actually ended up on the system. And you had everybody racing to build wind. And maybe prices were great when you did your analysis and raised your capital, but by the time your facility was constructed, 6,000 megawatts of other facilities were also coming online nearby, and it just caused prices to go down and down and down and down. And DPO has some materials that you might be able to find online that show, it's a kind of a color map that shows how much worse this problem has gotten over the last 10 years. And it shows that, you know, the darker colors and the purples are worse pricing in the market, and the area just keeps expanding and getting darker and darker. So from, I think the map probably shows like southern North Dakota, you know, down through Oklahoma and into the panhandle of Texas, you have all this transmission congestion because of all the wind that was built and all these negative prices. And there's not a lot of load in this area. So there's nowhere for the power to go until you build more transmission. And transmission takes a long time. It's hard to get permitted. It's expensive. It's hard to get people to want to pay for it. So you're kind of stuck, right? You have this wind farm that's going to continue producing power for a long time. And these production tax credits only last for 10 years. So we call it rolling off of PTCs, right? If you hear that term, it means your wind farm's 10 years old. You're not getting production tax credits anymore. Well, now your market hurdle rate isn't negative $40 a megawatt hour anymore, it's zero, right? So anytime prices are below zero, your wind farm's getting shut off. And some of these wind farms that have rolled off of PTCs are getting curtailed 20, 30% of the generation on an annual basis, which is crushing them. We have one client in Oklahoma, you know, the first time we talked to them, they were really excited. They said, our average clearing price last month was zero. Like, we didn't get paid anything for the power we made. Granted, it was a bad month, but, you know, their good months combined with the bad months averaged out to something like $19 a megawatt hour. They're saying that's terrible. That just barely covers my operating cost. And the only way for them to get access to higher value power is if somebody builds transmission. The challenge there is, as soon as somebody builds more transmission capacity, another 100, 200, 300 megawatts of wind is coming to make use of it.
Because why, production why, tax, why?
Because of the production tax credits.
Explain this to me. Yeah, but if they know that they built this and 5 years down the line, their margin gets compressed even more, why do they do it? Like what leads financiers to fund this stuff?
Because the production tax credits combined with just a little bit of market value is enough to finance the project. The revenue stream.
But if there's no market value, right? Let's say more and more wind comes online, mm-hmm. you build, and then your power is sold below zero, then there's no financial case for it. So I'm asking myself why they're still financing for it.
Well, in Texas, which could be true in other markets as well, but let's take Texas for example. You have more and so the frequency of very low or negative pricing is going up, but so is the frequency of large swings in pricing. So your extremes are getting greater on both ends. And we were just evaluating a wind site for a client a couple of weeks ago and came to the conclusion that it was something like 90% of their revenue comes from 6% of the hours. Because the price, and now granted, you throw a winter storm Uri event in there. People who have followed Texas are familiar with what that is, where, you know, you have this extreme reliability concern and prices go from, you know, $50 to $5,000 per megawatt hour. And if you're operating and delivering power, you're clearing quite a bit of revenue in those, you know, infrequent hours. So the problem for the wind operators in most areas, like the case that I gave you where, you know, prices averaged out over the course of a year under $20 per megawatt hour, that's the exception, not the rule. I think most of these wind farm operators are doing better than that. But the point is there are some that are doing really bad. And those are the great opportunities to build something behind the meter that's flexible, that allows the wind owner, and I'm getting a little bit into the structure of the deals that we educate folks on here. We shut off, they deliver their power to market when it's above whatever the clearing price is or the cutoff price is for mining Bitcoin. Let's say it's $100 a megawatt hour. If the market is north of $100 a megawatt hour, you shut off the Bitcoin mine, you deliver that to the market. And that allows you to still capture, you know, call it 80 to 90% of your market revenue that you otherwise would have collected. And the other, say, 20% is no longer going into that market. It's going into this market over here behind the meter. Still settles on 10-minute intervals, right? The market that you were dispatching into settled maybe every five. Now it's you got a 10-minute settlement period, but that's pretty darn close, right? You can coordinate real-time dispatch of do I want my power going left or right off the bus? And you put that power, you know, behind the meter in a Bitcoin mine, and your value stack at the site goes up tremendously. How much risk you're taking as a renewable asset owner is up to you, right? Do you want to vertically integrate where you're investing in the infrastructure and the computers and you're taking all the upside and also the downside? Or do you want, which most of our clients in the pipeline are a little bit more risk averse or a lot more risk averse and say, I love it, but my leadership's never going to get behind it. Like if I go into a leadership meeting at a regulated utility and I start talking about Bitcoin, they're going to ask me if I lost, you know, my mind. Like, what are you talking about here? We're a regulated energy company. What are you talking about Bitcoin? And we've had some regulated energy companies understand this enough to say, you know what, we'll enter an agreement with you guys. We're not ready to do something yet, but we'll sign you guys up. We'll ask you to, you know, keep things under NDA, keep things kind of to yourselves until we test the waters with our regulators and legislators and consumer advocacy groups enough to feel that they're also comfortable. And then we're ready to go. And that's a very, very slow process with regulated utilities. But, you know, you have other entities where maybe it's a large family office that was under a directive to own some renewable power. And they have 300 or 400 megawatts of wind under management. And they hear the idea and they feel, this is amazing. How fast can we go? So we have a very, very wide variety of risk tolerance with the people that we interact with, depending on who they answer to.
Is there so the way I can only speak from the German energy angle, the way it works there is if the utility shuts you off, right, then you still get paid government incentive, right? You get remunerated for the market price if the energy utility has to cut you off for demand response reasons. Is that the same where you operate or not?
Well, that sounds to me like a capacity component, right? So there are capacity markets and energy markets. Well, ERCOT doesn't have a capacity market, but there are, they don't call it a capacity market, but from my perspective, it kind of behaves like one where your ability to shut off is compensated. Whether you get paid for that in an annual capacity auction or through some kind of hourly market mechanism, whatever, it's dispatchable capacity or dispatchable load that can behave in a certain way when the market is really stressed. So I'd say yes, the markets are structured differently depending on where you are in the United States, right? There are regions of transmission operators that set up their markets in different ways. And maybe some of them are very similar to how it works in Germany and others are less similar, but I'd say, yeah, we have similar products there.
Okay, but from what I'm gathering, it's more easy to work with privately owned generation than it is with publicly owned generation.
In terms of right?
If there's a family office behind a wind farm funding this and they need revenue, then you have a much easier time than when it's a public utility that has to go through all the hoops first.
In general, yes, that's fair. There are some family offices that are just as risk averse as regulated utilities, and there are others that are not. There are some that require, you know, $10 to $50 million decisions to go all the way up the chain. And there are others where they delegate that down to one or two individuals. So how much freedom do you have to make decisions is always different, right? Everybody has a little different governance process for deploying capital.
Okay. And how do you feel that shifting? Maybe if you look back, how long has DPO been working on this?
A few years, three, four, I'd probably say, let's call it 4 years. So
if you compare this situation now from 4 years ago, would you say it has shifted materially or not?
There have been cycles. I'd say yes, the tides are shifting. So I think early on, you know, talking about Bitcoin was like people viewed it as some like monster in a closet. Like they had no idea what it was and they were scared of it. But the more Bitcoin was in the media, the more people talked about it. And the more you talk about it, the more you understand it. Things started building momentum right before the FTX collapse. And we had a whole bunch of entities that were saying, all right, things are really moving. This is great. I'd like to get involved. And then everybody pulled back and said, wait a minute, time out. You know, I'm not deploying my capital into this market right now. I'm getting a lot of questions that are concerning. So people pulled back. Yeah, there was still investment going, but I think the late adopters that were ready to move, in our view, they all pulled back. I think enough time has passed. You know, you've had federal regulation calm things down a bit. You have, you know, investor activity taking place with some individuals that I think utility shareholders, you know, are their money's diversified in a number of different companies. And when they're taking direction from people who are saying Bitcoin's a good market to start considering in your portfolio, people think differently. So I think it's taking a while for those conversations to move all the way down into utility executives' willingness to take risk investing in this technology. But I'd say it's moving in the right direction for sure.
Okay, so it becomes easier to identify to convince the promising sites. How do you find them in the first place? Maybe very briefly, like what does your process look like if you want to build a new site and need more stuff in the pipeline? How do you identify these sites that are a good potential for you guys?
Well, we've had, you know, boosted conferences where we've met some individuals. We do panels with groups like Bank of America, where they're invite only groups. They have some, you know, capital partners, maybe utilities. We've hit a number of different audiences with them where they bring us on. On Monday this week, we were actually part of a mini data center all day long event. Participated with a number of other entities, and you know, we get a number of follow-up calls from those. I'd say the bulk of renewable asset owners that we've spoken to, or people that have been responsible for managing renewable assets, have just been cold outreach. I think we spent a couple months and tried to reach out to just about everybody that owned a renewable asset that we could possibly find in the United States, and just said, let's have a conversation. And, you know, the hit rate is usually low on cold outreach like that, but it was good enough for us to drum up enough business to stay, you know, probably more busy than we'd like at times, and then build a pipeline and figure out who's serious about doing this now, who wants to wait a little bit. And I'd say, you know, for every entity that we have an agreement with, we probably have 15 more that we're under NDA with, and, you know, probably 50 more that are saying, I like it, but not today, but, you know, get back to me in 6 months or get back to me in a year.
What keeps them? So I'm assuming, and maybe I'm breaking your business case too far here. I'm assuming you're saying, hey, your wind farm is not making enough money. Let's set your floor price at X. We'll always be an off-taker for your power. And what keeps them is, first of all, is that in a nutshell correct? Or are you pitching them something? What does your pitch sound like?
I should ask. Well, our pitch tries to lead the owner of the renewable asset to own the data center. We think the best case scenario is vertical integration, where you're optimizing the asset and draw the box around the renewable asset, the transmission interconnection, and the data center, and say that's one entity that is optimizing that capital and that market participation. We think that's the best case. The reality is, you know, the owners of most renewable assets have a certain risk profile that they're under directive to manage, and this falls outside of that. So what's the next best, right, to that? It depends, but it's a lot easier for those entities to sell power in a PPA, right? And depending on whether you're in a regulated market or an unregulated market that takes on different forms, or in some cases, you know, is considered not allowed. But if you can be behind the meter purchasing power through a PPA, you know, and set a floor price, we have a large PPA that we've signed where we do exactly that. We say we'll always buy your power behind the meter, and we'll never pay you less than X.
And so this is, sorry to interrupt you, but this is exactly what I've been trying to tell folks, or trying to do in Germany, like couple of years ago, because there were a bunch of wind farms that fell out of their subsidy programs. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't do that because now the regulation says as soon as you connect it to the grid, you need to pay all of these fees, right? And there's just regulation that hinders me from doing it. So you're saying that's actually possible in there. Maybe go into what happens when they make more money selling to the grid than to your PPA. Like, how do you structure that?
We just shut off. It's that simple.
Okay.
So we essentially establish, you know, and there's the business case that says this is probably the price that we're going to shut off. But the reality is, as, you know, hash rate changes and as Bitcoin spot price changes, right, that number is going to change. So we just structure it that when they do day ahead dispatch, right, they essentially offer their wind into the market day ahead. There's a kind of daily coordination that says, well, this is the current spot price for Bitcoin. And, you know, we translate that into a dollar per megawatt hour basis. So they at least have a heads up on when they should not be offering their wind into the market because they're going to be giving it to us. And then in the real time market, right, those prices change, and we pay attention to that, and we shut off whenever the clearing price justifies doing that.
This is exactly what my question is. How do you put that level of flexibility into a PPA, though? You know, do you do daily updates and say, hey, today my farm, I don't know, at 23 joules per terahash, it does 20 cents per kilowatt hour. This is the floor price, or how do you structure that?
Sure. Well, we essentially just take the responsibility of managing dispatch into the market, and they're going to be paying attention to what we're doing. And if we're not, you know, complying with the terms of the agreement, they get to shut us off.
Okay, interesting. Okay, so manage the sales of the power.
Well, we don't manage the sale of the power. We just control how much power is being sold by whether or not we're online. And it's to our advantage, right? Because the price that we're paying is essentially the market price. So if we don't shut off, then we're just paying them whatever the market would pay them. and we're overpaying for power that we're using to mine Bitcoin that we shouldn't be using because, you know, the value of the Bitcoin is less than the power we're using to make it. So we have all of the incentive, and the owner of this asset has zero downside. The one exception being how you structure their credit risk, or how you structure their exposure to your creditworthiness is okay, a bit of a sweet sauce.
Before we get into that, I have not understood this.
Okay.
Lead me through the scenarios, right? Day ahead, the price is, I don't know, minus 20 per megawatt hour.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do?
Well, day ahead, we say anytime the price is below, I'm going to use 100 again. Anytime the price is below $100 per megawatt hour, we are going to be online. And they'll look at the day ahead forecast and say, okay, well, anytime the price is above 100, I'm going to dispatch my wind into the market. So that feels like they have $100 per megawatt hour dispatch price. And they know they're going to be delivering their power to market because they can trust us to shut off. But the payments for our power are based on the real-time price. Like, what was the power right now and how much power were we using right now on a five-minute basis, right? Because it's a five-minute market in most markets. And whatever that market price is, the owner of the renewable asset is getting paid that price for that volume of power, whether we're using it or the market's using it, doesn't matter. They're getting paid that price. So they don't really care where it goes.
Okay. If the price is above, you shut off. And how do you manage the risk of lower than average uptime of your machines?
We just have to accept it.
Okay. So if it changes and prices turn out to or translate to you being offline 10% of the year, that you just take that on the chin?
Yep. Okay. And I think that's fair. And that's, saying 10% off time. 10% downtime is probably a pretty reasonable expectation right now, given how volatile the markets are. And some people structure PPAs that are completely fixed, where they don't take that risk. But chances are they're paying more for their power than we are.
And how do you plan what machines to employ here? If you're not assuming 100% uptime, do you use lesser efficiency ASICs to make your money back quicker? Is that a thing?
I think it's reasonable to expect that the higher cost hash rate is going to go into applications with higher uptime, and the lower cost hash rate is going to go into and the less efficient machines, places with lower uptime. And DPO has a number of prospective projects in other countries, where at one of them being in South Africa, where uptime might be less than 50%. And, you know, we're anticipating having a home for some of these really old machines, right? Because there's going to be a surplus of really old inefficient machines. What do you do with them? Do you send them to the landfill? Because the power prices that they require to be profitable are very, very low. But you still need some uptime because it costs money to build transformers and, you know, concrete pads and containers, and, et cetera, and shipping. But there are places in countries where you have $0 power for, you know, 30, 40, 50% of the day. And it just makes sense to put old machines there.
What is your thinking as DPO about pulling power from the grid to replace the missing uptime?
In what way? I mean, we don't have a problem with it.
Do you say, hey, we want at least 95? Or what level of pricing can you accept in general from the grid, and how often do you get to pull that power at that price?
Well, if we're behind the meter at a solar facility, we're pulling power from the grid half the time, maybe more. If we're behind the meter at a wind asset and the size of our data center relative to the size of the wind asset allows us to have, say, 70 to 80% uptime just from the wind, then maybe we're only pulling power from the grid, you know, 15, 20, 30% of the time. But pulling power from the grid has a different cost profile associated with it. So when we're doing that, we're just mindful, like any other Bitcoin miner, to avoid some of those transmission or generation charges that have to do with coincident peaks, right? Shut off when you are causing, you know, a ratchet in price.
generally, would you say it's the correct line of thinking to say, hey, if we have to pull power from the grid, it means the wind is not blowing. And if the wind is not blowing here, it probably is not blowing elsewhere. And therefore, power price is probably too high.
I'd say there definitely is a correlation between wind speed and price. It's not a perfect correlation, but there's definitely a correlation there. And you can expect that as, let's say you're behind, say you have a 50 megawatt Bitcoin mine behind the meter at a 500 megawatt wind farm, right? It has to be very not windy, you know, to not be producing 50 megawatts. It has to almost be completely calm to not produce 50 megawatts in a 500 megawatt wind farm. But that happens. And it's not like your wind farm is going to go from, you know, 300 or 400 megawatts of output to zero in, you know, 2 minutes, right? Sometimes that happens, you know, quite quickly, but usually, you know, the wind speed is changing in a way you can, you know, forecast at least 5 to 10 minutes ahead what's going to happen. You know, just by paying attention to what's happening, you know, as the wind fronts come through, right, it's affecting other wind farms before it's affecting your wind farm. And you can just see what are the patterns of energy production in my local region. And you can anticipate when prices are going to, or when conditions are going to be such that prices are going to be high, and get really good at forecasting when you probably should shut off. Because you don't want to be chasing, you know, if your dispatch hurdle rate is $100 per megawatt hour, and prices are going from 99 to 101, you know, it's not like you're slamming this thing on and off constantly. You're looking for patterns in price changes to follow. And, you know, maybe you lose a couple dollars a megawatt hour, you know, this hour, but you make 20 the next hour by being online and not shutting off. And I'd say that's a bit of an art that our data center team is paying attention to more than me.
Okay. You do talk to regulators as well, or is that just the generation side of the business?
I think we're a pretty significant,
I guess.
Yeah, I'd say I think we're a pretty significant influence in how energy companies talk to their regulators about this technology. We've written leadership memos or drafted leadership memos for some folks to run up the chain. We've drafted regulatory strategies for utility regulatory groups to lean on to help them understand how to engage folks, how to tell the story, how to respond to certain questions, how to anticipate questions from stakeholders, and what useful responses should include in the conversation. So are we engaging directly? I'm thinking, have we engaged directly with regulators themselves? Yeah, perhaps, but we try to have our energy clients do the direct engagement with their stakeholders and not us. You know, lean on us for expertise.
That's what I meant. Yeah, that's what I meant. Can you give me tidbits of things that people might not expect of how you structure those memos or those it's almost like a conversation flowchart. Like if they say this, say this. What goes into this? Like how do you explain Bitcoin mining without mentioning the word Bitcoin?
Well, you have to get there. But you start the conversation by, or at least we advise our utility clients to start the conversation by assuming that who they're talking to doesn't know anything about Bitcoin at all. And try and establish some commonplace where you're talking in the same language that they understand. And the best example that I can think of on the spot is to pick another technology that they're familiar with. Maybe they've reviewed a business case and approved a project for a technology you can point to. And if you take a look at a battery storage system, I'd say most regulators in all levels of the regulatory agency have been required to evaluate or make a decision about a battery project. So let's pick up that business case and open it up and put a data center in place of the battery project. What is the same and what is different? Well, with a battery project, you pretty much repurpose the identical Excel model. If you're modeling this in Excel at a desktop level, you take that same Excel model and you just change the numbers. It's the same thing, right? It's acting like a battery. The only thing it can't do is charge, right? But this thing is discharge. The only thing it can't do is put power on the grid. So it has the charging side of a battery project and the CapEx, the O&M, right? All of the things that you need in order to understand whether or not a battery project is good for utility customers. That's all you need
Same
to know.
Inputs.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all you need to know. It's just a battery that never discharges back to the grid. It settles in real-time markets just the same. When a battery charges, it's consuming power from the grid. Same with a data center. It's very, very flexible to adapt to what's going on in real-time markets. But that's all you really need to know. So whether it's that example or some other example, start with how do you get them to think about this through a lens that they understand, so they're not sitting across the table going, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know how to make sense of this. You know, like, because a lot of people, especially in a regulated environment, get apprehensive about making decisions about things they don't understand. So
yeah,
I'd say that's where you start. And then you point to some of the issues that are on the electric grid in the area they're responsible for and say, how do you feel about, you know, all of this transmission congestion? You know, have you found solutions for it? What are they? And, you know, kind of get them thinking about problems on the system they'd like to see go away. And then say, remember that battery, you know, we were talking about? Well, if you put those in those areas, right, does that problem get better or worse? If they think about it, it's like, well, it'd probably get better. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to put these value batteries in those locations to create value. And you don't really have to talk about Bitcoin mining in the process.
You gotta make people walk there themselves almost by asking them the right questions.
I think so.
It's very analog to making somebody understand what Bitcoin is. Right. So something that I do to the, for instance, the Uber driver, when I go to the airport from my house, for instance, like, why can I give you R100 South African rand bill, a piece of paper mm-hmm. with Nelson Mandela on it, and you give me your time, your petrol, your car to get me from A to B, you know? And then you understand, okay, you know what money is and what good money is and so on and so forth. But it's always good to ask questions. So it sounds like you're applying a similar strategy, which is good. Good to hear. Because especially energy folks, you know, they're some of the most conservative industries out there, because all that matters to them is grid stability. And anything funky coming along that says, hey, we do this thing differently. We have this battery, but it doesn't discharge. It's a data center. It's Bitcoin mining. It's like, what are you talking about? Please, like, leave me alone, you know?
Well, I tell people that in that environment where we're talking with folks that we want to be supportive of a project or a capital investment, when they start asking questions about the details of Bitcoin, I try and get them to understand they don't need to know. They don't need to understand that. In the same way that if you have a different technology that's, you know, just interacting with the grid and the energy market, you don't. If somebody comes to you with a wind project, you don't say, "Explain to me how the market settlement process works and what the technology is in order for, you know, the market monitor." Like, yeah. They don't get into those details. Like, so why are you asking those questions about Bitcoin? It doesn't matter. What's happening is you have an energy node that has transactions going across it, right? And your stakeholders are benefiting from it. Like, it doesn't matter how the market is structured or settles to the same way it doesn't matter today.
Well, what you wanted to get into earlier was the credit risk. And this is where it gets important, right? I would argue, and I would disagree with you, because I would say, hey, you can say all day long, these machines, this data center makes 20 cents per kilowatt hour, but where does come from? Where does the money come from? Why does it make that? How much is that secured? Is that a 2-year thing? Is it gone in 5 years? I don't know. And to understand where Bitcoin ASICs get their revenue from, you kind of have to understand Bitcoin a little bit and understand what the price is and why it's 70K right now. And, you know, what's going on the fiat side of things when it comes to the hash price, to understand where my revenue comes from, right?
I would say with traditionally sited and powered Bitcoin mines, I would agree with you. But with the types of projects that we try to get energy companies to build, I wouldn't agree mm-hmm. with you. I would say you don't have to understand what's going on with Bitcoin or pay attention to it, because as long as Bitcoin exists, our strategy works because we're going after the lowest value power on the planet. And there's a market.
But isn't that the point, Eric? Sorry, isn't that the point? As long as Bitcoin exists, if you don't understand Bitcoin, you cannot assess the risk of, does this thing go away in a year?
Well, I'd say if you're concerned that Bitcoin might go away in a year, you should be shorting anything that's tied to Bitcoin, and you're going to do very well if you're right. You know?
Sure.
So
yeah, sure. But I'm an energy guy. I don't trade in the markets. I want my wind propeller to go all day long. I'm thinking of kids' songs right now. Wheels on the bus.
Sure.
But so, you know what I mean? Like,
absolutely. And we interact with folks who aren't even willing to get comfortable with the idea of Bitcoin existing 12 months from now, right? For whatever reason. Okay, then let's structure this transaction in such a way where you don't have any downside risk. Your upside is going to be razor thin, right? If you want somebody else to take all of the risk, then your value coming out of this facility is going to be adjusted accordingly, right? But if an extra $1 to $2 per megawatt hour from your wind farm is good enough, and you're like, it's not going to, you know, get me really excited, but I like $2 a megawatt hour more than zero, so sure, sign me up. And then the conversation is very, very much about how do I structure this PPA or whatever the transaction is to make that counterparty absolutely certain that we aren't going to have credit problems, right? Where we can't pay our bills. Because if they're only getting $1 or $2 per megawatt hour total, and we don't pay 1 month's energy bill, right? They lose, right? So they're very, very sensitive to how we structure the contract to make sure that they always get paid and that they can shut us off if there's a risk of us not paying.
Okay, so let's talk about this this topic a bit more, because that was really interesting when we first talked before the recording. And correct me if I'm summing this up incorrectly, right? So what you said to me was Bitcoin miners traditionally have bad credit rating and the loans that they get to post collateral is very expensive. So therefore, it's often a problem if you say to a Vin developer, hey, why don't you develop all of this infrastructure so I can come and hash at your beautiful site? And then they will say, yeah, but so to you, what happens if you're gone in 6 months? Can you please post, I don't know, X amount as collateral? And the miners are like, not really, because I'm paying 6, 7, 8% on a loan for that. What needs to change there? Is that, first of all, is that summed up correctly?
Yeah, that's fair representation. It's, you know, it costs money to tie up capital.
And then what's the solution there? Where is this going? What does this look like? What did this look like 4 years ago?
Yeah, that's where I don't know if I really want to get into the sweet sauce. I feel like DPO has done a really good job working with the large risk-averse energy companies to structure deals that work for them. And, you know, that might be what sets us apart a little bit, is we have a prescription that we can bring to the table and say, we've worked through all of your concerns. They're the same concerns that utility A, B, C, D, and E have had that we've worked with. We've reached agreement. This is what it looks like. This is how you can do business to address those concerns. And, you know, it took a lot of work. The first contract that we signed with a large risk-averse energy company took us probably 18 months to figure out just how we have to structure this to get them comfortable. And it was, you know, they were running things up the chain, you know, and back down and up the chain and back down to eventually, you know, and the conversation sped up as the contract became more clear and we got closer to the finish line. But the reality is, you know, they didn't know what it was going to look like at the end. And it took a long time for us to figure it out and work together to get there.
And what does a conversation sound like 3 months in? You know, the ASICs have been there for 3 months. They're making more money than before. How quickly does the conversation switch in tone from before you had to convince them to now they're like, okay, this works?
Yeah, I'd say assume things are similar to how most energy projects go, at least in my experience, which is there's a lot of conversation about releasing capital into the project. And then once the capital is released, everybody just kind of goes away, right? All right, you got the money to do the project. Don't come back to me unless there's a problem I have to deal with, because I'm going to spend my time evaluating where to spend, you know, the next $300 million. And as long as things are running smoothly, people tend to just say, great, you know, thanks for the monthly update.
Okay. All right. No flowers.
No.
Okay. How do you raise money for this? You have a new site, I don't know, 50 megs. You need to build a Bitcoin mine. Where do you get the money typically from?
So our founders, our former, you know, investment bankers, they spent a lot of time doing exactly that, raising capital and structuring debt. Okay. And they're good at it. And they had, I'd say probably, you know, a Rolodex with a couple hundred people in it that they started with saying, are you interested in getting into this space? We've met investors or investment groups. We just bought a hydro facility in the middle of the country, and the entity that financed that, Aegon, we met them at a conference. Like, we had no idea we were going to run into them, but we did. We had a conversation. They liked what they heard, and they ended up investing in a hydro facility that we just acquired.
That's amazing. Okay, cool. Eric, is there anything that I haven't asked you? Because I feel like we covered a broad topic. We're coming up on time a little, so just want to make sure. Is there anything that you wish I had asked you before?
No, I mean, we could probably go on for hours, you know, and talk about other topics, but
easy.
You know, I think maybe just a conversation about the pace at which this is moving versus the pace at which it should be moving. You know, and one thing I try and remind people is to just be patient, right? There are a lot of people that would like to do this that can't for one reason or the other. And if you get a no, come back to them. You know, just keep the conversation warm, because some entities are just much slower to engage than others. I'm all hoping that the pace of this picks up, you know, in the right places.
Does Bitcoin consume enough electricity, Eric?
I think hopefully Bitcoin consumes just enough electricity to secure the network and not a megawatt hour more. I don't know if that's where we're at. I don't know if it requires twice the power or half the power. You know, my gut says that the Bitcoin network was developed in such a way that it's going to move equipment to the lowest value sources of power over time. And you're going to see less volatility in the cost per megawatt hour or the value per megawatt hour of mining Bitcoin. And eventually the volatility is going to settle out, and the Bitcoin market is going to be a nice stable ecosystem where there's just enough power online to secure the network and not a megawatt hour more.
Right. Sounds good to me. Eric, where can people find you? What do you want to leave them with? Where can they find more about DPO?
DigitalPowerOptimization.com is our website. Info@DigitalPowerOptimization.com is a general mailbox that folks can reach out to us at. I'd say that's probably your best bet. And, you know, pay attention to that website for links to things like this, and stay updated. But send an email if you want to get a weekly or a monthly update from DPO. Hit that inbox up, and we'll get you on our distro list.
What can people find in there typically?
Well,
in a monthly update.
Yeah. So Andrew, our founder and CEO, pretty much just talks about what's going on in the industry, what happened the last month. It's not specific to Bitcoin. It's kind of data center technology in general. There's a lot of stuff going on in AI, right? So our monthly updates took on a different tone about 9 months ago and started directing people's attention to that. So I'd say they're gonna hear whatever has been going on in the last, you know, 4 to 6 weeks from the perspective of DPO.
All right, dear listeners, dear viewers, I hope you learned something new. If you do, or if you did, you know what to do. I try to give you everybody a brief overview of what goes into, or me and Eric, I should say, what goes into building one of these sites, what considerations you have to make, what the potential is, and so on and so forth. If you have any questions, go via the channels that Eric just mentioned, or post them to us. Are you on Twitter, Eric?
I am not.
Okay. Are you on LinkedIn?
I am. Yeah. Okay. I'm kind of an old energy guy. I don't have much in the way of social media, but I do have a LinkedIn account.
Okay. So that might be another one. Yeah. Again, if you learn something new, you know what to do. Next Sunday, we talk mining again. I'm not sure who that's going to be with yet, but I'm sure it's going to be exciting. Yeah. See you next time, guys. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on, Jesse.
Sorry, cut you off there.
No, just saying thanks for having me on.